hello, everyone, and welcome to the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group podcast series. I'm Jessica Lester, the current chair of the Qualitative Research SIG, and I'm pleased to be facilitating today's conversation with Dr. Kakali Padacharya, who will be sharing about aligning critical qualitative methodologies with critical theoretical frameworks. Dr. Kakali is an associate professor of qualitative research for the College of Education, which is housed in the Department of Educational Leadership at Kansas State University. Her work has opened up new spaces in interdisciplinary decolonizing work and qualitative research, where creativity and contemplative approaches are legitimized and seen as necessary gateways for cultivating depth, expansive inquiry, and discovering critical insights. She has published 34 refereed articles, 5 books, 10 book chapters, holds editorial responsibilities with a Routledge book series entitled Futures of Data Analysis and Qualitative Research. And she is also the guest editor of 4 special issues in journals such as Qualitative Inquiry, International Review of Qualitative Research, and Writing Across Disciplines. Her work has explored methodological and theoretical possibilities of decolonizing qualitative research for the past decade. She's been invited to speak over 25 times, delivering keynote and plenary lectures, and has been a guest speaker nationally and internationally. She has won the 2017 Outstanding Publication Award from American Educational Research Association and the 2017 Outstanding Book Award from the International Congress of Qualitative Inquiry for her co-authored text with Norman Gillan entitled Power, Race, and Higher Education: A Cross-Cultural Parallel Narrative. She is also the author of the text, Foundations of Qualitative Research, a Practical Guidebook, published by Routledge. She's been nominated for 6 National Outstanding Teaching, Research, and Mentoring Awards and has won a Distinguished Faculty and Distinguished Presenter Award from Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi. Furthermore, she has been the featured speaker for SAGE Research video series for her expertise in critical and decolonial qualitative research, and has been featured by both Texas A&M University Corpus Christi and Kansas State University for her research and pedagogies. Most recently, she's been invited by the International Institute for Qualitative Methods to deliver a TED-style lecture on decolonial qualitative methodologies. It is a great pleasure to welcome you, Kakali, and learn from you around critical qualitative methodologies. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica, and thank you for that introduction. It's kind of odd to hear all about you like that.
Well, to begin, Kakali, can you share a bit around how you conceptualize critical qualitative methodologies?
You know, I thought about this question, and I thought about this question everywhere. Like, when I walk, I think about this question after you posed it to me. I thought about it in the bathroom, in the shower, everywhere. Which is also the place where I do my best thinking. Is where, you know, like, when I first started my work, you know, I thought I was doing decolonial work. Then over the years, people started calling it critical. Some people called it humanistic. Some people called it post-qual. And I began to just sort of almost drop the label to just this one thing that all of us were doing in some form or another in any of these, you know, labels was interrogating power in one way or another. You know, so I think the labels are very fluid in these spaces. I think, like, if somebody is doing something in a critical space, they might also use some things from deconstructive scholars, and deconstructive scholars use something from modernist folks. You know, we just kind of, like, hybridize ourselves so much that I thought the only thing that I can see that remained consistent across these labels is that in some way, shape, or form, if someone's doing critical work, you know, they're interrogating power in some way. So that's really where I have started to conceptualize critical work, is you study power, you interrogate power, you look at how power manifests, you look at how power circulates, you look at, you know, how power plays out in people's lived realities, you look at how power creates other systems of inequities, you look at how interconnected structures of power are, and what kind of illusion it creates in terms of, you know, pathways of liberation and oppression, you know, where it keeps you limited. So I'm sort of saying this generically, but then it can go into various you know, situated perspectives as well. So that can be feminist work, that can be race-based work, that can be intersectional work, that can be LGBTQ work, that can be work that people are doing with disability studies. So it can go anywhere, really. It's just a matter of, you know, grounding it in some understanding of power and circulation of power and interrogating it.
To flesh out this idea a little bit further, could you share an example from your own work wherein you engaged in this interrogation of power?
Sure. So I'll start with the first work that I did. You know, the first work that I did was my dissertation. And in that dissertation, I looked at the ways in which graduate students who just arrived from India in a U.S. university negotiated their spaces in formal and informal academia. Mm. And the reason why I wanted to do that, and I did it like within a year of their arrival, is that usually people notice when they travel to a different place, like what is different about that place, mm-hmm. you know, and things that I wouldn't notice anymore by being in this space for as long are things that they would notice as something that's looking awry or standing out to them, and they're questioning it. And in tracing those things, I was able to trace a lot of things that, you know, were in the informal or sometimes even in the invisible structures or invisible curriculum or invisible structures of higher education that created certain types of oppression that were gender-based, race-based, nationality-based, you know. So simple things like, you know, could they really go to a professor and say, you know, I need to go home, and I need to go home for at least a month over the holidays, so I need to know when can I stop working in this lab so that I can buy a ticket, mm. you know, to do that. And even that kind of, for Christmas, even that kind of question or a request or a query was met with, you know, quite a bit of resistance, you know, and not a serious sort of engagement of like, oh, okay, well, you have been completely dislocated for a whole year. You might want to go to your family, and I'd be enjoying my time with my family, but I'd like to keep your labor over here regardless, you know, like, so there's that, you know, exertion of power. And because of the power difference, they weren't able to always like establish themselves. Like they, you know, so instead of going away for a month, which would have been far more valuable for them to see their family, they went away maybe for a week, which if anybody has traveled internationally will know, like the travel from US to other part of the world is usually 18 hours. So that's like 2 days there, 2 days back. And then you have jet lag in between. So if you do it a week, then you only have 3 days with your family, you know. So mm-hmm. So that's a huge, you know, and so when you dislocate people from their own cultures, their own connections, places from where they draw strength, while you get to do that effortlessly, then you are further oppressing that person and you're isolating that person, which becomes very abusive too, mm-hmm. you know. And so that's one of the ways that power works, where, you know, no one's calling you a name, but they're using their power to create, you know, experiences that are clearly very oppressive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a really, really useful example. So what do you view then as some of the most important considerations or even key questions for scholars who plan to engage with critical methodologies and or critical theoretical frameworks?
I think first, you know, in our field, we have this saying, homework before fieldwork. You know, lots of people before us have come and said this, right? So I think it's really important to know what is compelling about this work for someone. You know, like, why are they drawn to this work? Until they know that, it is very, very difficult to get distracted by everything that's around them like a sponge, you know, and not having, you know, very good discernment about where they need to go with that. And I have faced that certainly in my own, you know, journeys as well, and still do to some extent, and then I have to pull away from it to say, no, I can't be like shiny here, shiny there, shiny there. squirrel, I can't do that. I mean, I can do that. I mean, I'm free to do whatever I want in that space, but I want to be purposeful and intentional about what I'm doing. So I think it's really important to know, you know, what is compelling in this work for you, other than to say, like, it's wrong and I'm a social justice scholar. I think it's good to ask yourself the question, so then what? And then what? And then what? And then what? And then you go to a place, and this is where some of my contemplative work comes in. You know, a lot of this comes through, you know, centering, walking, mm-hmm. meditating, writing, you know, moving, just anything that will pull away the noise a little bit from you, so that you can kind of get quiet and go to a place where from where you can seek guidance within, or just, you know, develop some insights, you know, without the other chatters. And then you might come to a place where you will know, like, I want to do this work because whatever that is, beyond, like, I'm just a social justice scholar, because social justice has become such a buzzword. But when I was doing this work, that term wasn't there. We were just doing the work, you mm-hmm. know. Now it's a term, and it gets completely co-opted by so many people. So losing labels, losing all of that, to really understand what is compelling about this work, what is their ethics around it, you know, what are their philosophies and beliefs about this work, you know, when the going gets tough and they hit a wall, can they sustain themselves because of how important this work is to them? You know, these are sort of the foundational questions and work that we must do within ourselves before we move forward, because it gets hard. We all know academia is hard, and we all have our own barriers and challenges and mountains and, you know, potholes and all of these things. And if we want to keep going, it has to be more than because you want to survive in academia. It has to be because it's a cause beyond your own survival, beyond careerism, beyond something that is just isolated in one individual's, you know, amount of publications or presentation. At least that's my ethics, mm-hmm. you know. So, because if it's just careerism, then it doesn't matter. Then there's no point in listening to me, because I can't speak to that, because that's not my philosophy, you know. Mm-hmm. But if it is beyond, if somebody's considering doing something beyond themselves, then they really need to know why this matters, so that they can sustain themselves when things are very challenging. And things, if anyone's doing critical work, I would be surprised that if they have a challenge-free life. You know, critical work does not produce work that is palatable for all, especially status quo folks, especially mm-hmm. people in positions of power. So it's risky work, and people draw attention to themselves when they become good at it. And then that becomes, then they become target of people who want to, you know, use power structures to oppress them. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think that if someone wants to can go to this work, the first step, not that there is a first step, I don't want to be linear about it, but one of the first orientation to it would be, you know, researcher, know thyself, you know, mm-hmm. like, what's mm-hmm. your positionality? What's your own subjectivities, what's your own epistemologies, where are you coming from, what's your belief, you know, is this something that is connected to your ancestry, to your people, to your culture, you know, where is all this, you know, where are you in all of this, you know. Once that happens, then I think it's also important to see, you know, within the space that they are going to want to work in, they have to see how power functions in that space too. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you want to work in qualitative methods or critical qualitative methods, there are power hierarchies within that space as well, mm-hmm. you know, and they have to see how that happens. And because that there are power hierarchies in that space, I think it's important to know, how do they want to situate themselves within that space? You know, mm-hmm. do they want to align with the hierarchy? Does it meet, and is it in integrity with them? Is it congruent to their own, you know, worldviews and beliefs and philosophies and ethics? Can they go to sleep well? You know, like, those things are really, really important to think about. And because what ends up happening in academia is that, even when we do work that is resistant work, if somebody becomes really good at what they're saying or doing, we tend to center those people, and then we get very incestual about citing certain people for mm-hmm. certain types of work. You know, we cite each other, we cite our friends cite us, and wow, we have a field already, you know? so that happens a lot. And so we would have to have a critical discernment to say, is there all that is, or are there people that are doing work, but they're maybe underrepresented, but they're also doing some really fierce work too. What mm-hmm. I've found is some of the fierce work that's coming up is coming up from people who are doing dissertation work, mm-hmm. you know, just because they have so much time to work on a product and think about things and get feedback and have been working on this idea for a while and thinking about it and having clarity on it. I've seen very sharp dissertations that are, you know, important to read to keep your ideas fresh. So it's important to kind of look at like who's winning dissertation awards in these spaces, you know, mm-hmm. and then pulling up those dissertations to look at that work and to see what we can learn from that, you know, not to only just learn from academic elders, that certainly is valuable, you know, but academic contemporaries are, you know, people who are coming up, emergent scholars. It's important to see things in the center, but also to see things that are not centered just as yet, mm-hmm. you know. So I would say that, you know, that would be my most important feedback is know thyself and know how power works in your field and figure out how you want to situate yourself to that.
Wow, so many powerful insights here. I want to back us up to something that you mentioned. You talked about how when scholars often engage in critical work, that it's often not palatable for all. Those are your words. And you talked about it being risky work. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
Yeah, so, you know, if you're doing anti-racist work and you're in a predominantly white institution and you're critiquing higher education for being racist, you know, while you're drawing salary from higher education, you know, you're the troublemaker within, right? So if you're the troublemaker within and you are pushing for change from within and you are philosophically oriented to not ingratiate yourself to power, you know, and I'll speak mm-hmm. about my experience. I'm philosophically oriented to not become a token, you know. Mm-hmm. So that means that there are times when I'm speaking and there are times when I'm resisting, there are times when I'm in solidarity with students' resistance, and all of that draws attention on me, and mm-hmm. and I am with a brown woman's body, I am now by in other people's eyes have stepped out of my lane, you know, mm-hmm. and then that means the disciplinary power structures need to be imposed on me because I need to know my place, because I'm rattling things around a little too much and it's disrupting power. So when you disrupt power, power shows, you know, what it can do to you, mm-hmm. you know, and because it shows what it can do to maybe one disruptor, then by example of that, it can silence the other people who are bearing witness to that. You know, mm-hmm. and so then other folks would be like, okay, well, then maybe I'm just going to be quiet. I'm just going to do my work. And if they're untenured, then that makes it even riskier, you know. So if you do critical work only to please people because you're just saying some very, very palatable things, we all need to be equal, we need to love each other, we need to have opportunities for everyone, if you say things like that, you know, those are really palatable things to say, and you can label yourself critical if you want, mm. but it's not really that's just ingratiating yourself to power. It's not really going into the deeper analysis of what is actually sustaining these inequities and who are the key players, you know, that are sustaining inequities. And when you tell the oppressor group that they are complicit in oppressing you and people who look like you or other folks as well, they don't want to hear that, you know, because there is nothing that first, they don't want to hear that because it's not, you know, it's not pleasant. Second, they don't necessarily always want to, be in a position where they want to interrogate privileges, you know, because when someone's privileged and holds a lot of power, there is no incentive to unlearn and unpack that. Like nothing bad would happen to that person or to that group or to that entity if they don't unpack that, you know. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times what it ends up being, and that's that's been sort of some of my point of reflection, is I go back to Audre Lorde's, master's tools cannot break the master's house. And I sometimes think that the power structures are such that a lot of times we're taking the master's tools and like breaking a room inside the master's house and making a little extra space for ourselves. And maybe we're breaking another wall. And then we think, oh, look, we are changing from within. And we are, you know, that those rooms, we didn't have access to each other in these rooms inside the master's house. So then we're coming in solidarity together. And that's good. But I think, well, as long as we're in the master's house, you know, I don't know what our goal is then, is it to make the master a benevolent dictator, you know? And, that, and even then, that's not going to work out because the master really has no incentive whatsoever to do anything we ask the master to do. So then if you want to do critical work, you're going to have to imagine being outside the master's house. You might have to access outside the master's house. You might have to look for tools that are not the master's tools, and all of that's disruptive to the master's house, you know? And so that's when things become dangerous because, you know, if you're that invisible on the margin and that the center doesn't know about you, you're not disciplined, and that's fine. You just do your work. But if you begin to get visibility, then you also begin, the amount of support you have for that is sometimes becomes, you know, also proportional to the amount of challenges you have for that work, especially if the power structures feel that you are trying to disrupt and dismantle them.
That's really powerful ideas. I am drawn to this idea that you mentioned of imagining outside the master's house. I'll certainly sit with that one for quite a long time. You also mentioned previously that it's important to think about who you're citing and how we can very easily begin to only cite particular people or even our friends or ourselves. Can you talk a little bit about how you make decisions around who to cite when engaging in work that draws upon critical theoretical perspectives?
Yeah, so this, you know, my students know, and I know those who are listening to me right now will probably giggle because I have prevented anybody I have a power relationship with, you know, using my power somewhat ethically, I think, to prevent them from citing Creswell and Patton if they're doing, you know, critical work. And this is not to denigrate that work, and I don't want to, although I know the critiques exist, you know, as to, you know, so why that work may be considered to be work that has some weaknesses in them, but that's not where I'm at. Where I'm at is, you know, when people like Creswell or Patton, you know, middle-aged, older, white men are writing these texts, you know, especially Creswell, let me get there. Creswell's very popular worldwide, globally popular worldwide. And so if we are looking at Creswell's work, he does, you know, a summary of what exists in the field. His books are intro texts, and he does summary of what exists in the field. If people are interested in knowing more about this work, then they're going to have to go and look at the people who are the originators of those work, not Creswell's paraphrase summary of it. And so if people are citing Creswell in it, then they're essentially telling their reader that they have an introductory level understanding, like a, you know, their understanding is bearing witness to Creswell's work. So it's a third person understanding of what Creswell's understanding is of that work. So that's like 3 degrees removed from the actual work, you know, and that makes no sense to me. And then secondly, Creswell's not a critical scholar. Creswell is a textbook writer who writes accessible textbooks that are picked up by the world, and they enjoy it because it creates an entry point to an otherwise very complex, you know, area of inquiry. However, that entry point is a very simplistic entry point, and I often have to complicate, you know, after people have entered the space, things that they have learned from that text because it's so simplistic, you know. So if we have to do that work and we're doing work in critical spaces, then we have to look at scholars who are deeply immersed in that so that we don't come out and say that we have a superficial understanding of this. You know, and I think I'm really pointing on the superficiality here, that if we are going to really say, I'm interrogating power, I'm interrogating power structures, I'm interrogating ways in which inequities are functioning in this space for this people, for this group, for this policy, whatever it is that people are wanting to do, you know, we would have to at least then dig deep into that space and look at all the literature in that space to see how it gets, you know, taken up, how it gets silent, how it gets, you know, celebrated, and who is doing that work. And so I think that's where my citational politics comes. And, you know, I look at like, who is doing that deep work? Who is doing that deep critical work that I can go to and I can understand and I can read and I can immerse and I can sit with and I can get angry with, or whatever it is, you know, something that moves me out of my place of knowing now to a different place of knowing and being and questioning and shifting and all of these things. And if I have scholarship like that, that's who I cite. You know, I don't cite generic scholarship because that's not going to get me into a deep place. So generally speaking, that's my citational politics. Now, I also think that academia, so talking about, like, you know, you have to know how power circulates in your space. Well, in academia, you know, a lot of people's work don't get cited because, you know, for whatever reason. For example, I have a friend who wrote, you know, a brilliant article on ways in which teachers, professors, and students could, you know, get into a position that could be, you know, somewhat of a romantic position. Mm-hmm. However, some of that came from previous abuse and incest. And, you know, right now we have a lot of discussion, you know, in social media about sexual abuse and harassment and, you know, rape and all of that. So it was grounded in that. And in this article that she wrote, nothing actually happened between her and the student, but she wrote a beautiful autobiographic article with shadow character and illuminated some of these tensions. Like, if you carry that in your background and your student also carries that in your background and they all come to the same space, what are some of the ways in which it gets messy, you know? And it's a really brilliant piece, but her university would not let her publish it. She won an award for the paper, but her university will not let her publish it because they didn't think it's safe. And she said she can have consent from the student. The student was gone like 10 years after this had happened, she wrote this. And they said that would be coercion, which it wouldn't have been coercion, but they thought it would be. So they forbade her to write it on even like a little napkin. If it's published anywhere, like, they would sue her. So as my resistance to that, I give that article for all of my students to read, and they cite it as unpublished article. And so sometimes I play with academic power structure like that, you know, mm-hmm. and people who have been rendered invisible, or their work has been rendered invisible. And if there's power in that work, I would, you know, I would expose people to that as well. And I've cited other folks. I've cited my cultural elders. I've cited people on the streets. I've cited singers, poets, rappers, you know. I just feel like knowledge making is not just limited in academia and refereed articles and books and book chapters. Knowledge making happens everywhere. And there are a lot of people who are capable of doing very critical thinking and critical theorizing that may not exist in academia. Mm-hmm. So to me, that is thinking outside of the master's house, you know, mm-hmm. that you have to only use these tools to get yourself some nice spot inside the master's house, you know. So I've gone outside, I've cited comedians. Comedians are really good at deconstructing power and pointing out things in a very extreme way, but they do that. So I've cited just everyday people, you know, mm-hmm. in my work to sort of mess with that citational politics as well.
Mm-hmm. So if you are someone who is really drawn to critical methodologies and theories, but perhaps you have only this entry level understanding or really no understanding or background, what would be some advice that you would give to that kind of individual?
Well, the first advice I would give is, it's going to sound very counterintuitive, you know, is to go talk to their own, you know, community elders, you know, to not go to academic space first, you know, go go to your community elders and have a conversation about, you know, how to think about this work. You know, like, because when you go through academia and you read all the things that you read, sometimes you lose that kind of raw knowledge and raw intelligence that you bring to the space, and you get a little bit widgetized in academia. So it's really, really important to be connected to the community and to hear community elders, because community elders often can do a lot of critical thinking. They've seen a lot. They understand how power works. They have been at the receiving end of inequities, and they're very critical minded, you know, effortlessly, without having to, you know, watch for who they cite or not cite and center this or not. You know, a lot of community elders are, and older people generally also speak with less filter too, you know. So it's really good to sort of see what you get from your community elders, you know, to walk in with some sort of conceptual framework or understanding that comes from, you know, a very organic indigenous space for that person. You know, and then when you walk into these academic spaces, you know, look at like where you find resonance with and where you find dissonance with. I think those two are equally important. The dissonance is just as important, because it might be showing something to you that you haven't been shown before, or it could reveal to you even a deeper way power operates that you didn't know and didn't get from your community elders. But that community elders piece is important, because you don't want to lose that piece, because the work is not just for gaining space in academia. The work is probably to, you know, benefit a community, you know, in which the person is situated.
So many powerful insights that I will certainly sit with. I'm still sitting with this, thinking outside the master's house, imagining outside the master's house.
Yeah,
I'm sure that many people are much like me and have much that they can really sit with here. If those that are listening want to follow your work and also follow your thinking, what are some of the ways that they can engage with you either online or through other venues?
I am active on Facebook the most. I think I don't know how people can be active on multiple social media platforms. I admire them, because just being active on Facebook takes up a lot of my time, you know. So I am active on Facebook. They can find me on Facebook. They can find me on Twitter. If they're not on social media, if they go to ResearchGate, you know, a lot of my work is in ResearchGate that are available for people to download there. They can download full text of my work in ResearchGate. And if all of that fails, they can Google me up and email me, and I'll be happy to talk to them.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Kakali, for joining me this morning. It has been a true pleasure to learn from you.
Thank you for creating the space for me, Jessica.